This is Surviving the Music Industry.
That sounds sick.
I didn't think about how that sounded.
Oh, come on. You know what you did. You didn't know what that app was. It's an actual podcast app on your phone. And you accidentally pushed it. And then you've accidentally landed on my show. Well, what a happy accident. Welcome, one and all. If you happen to be a repeat offender, thanks for swinging back. Thanks for repeating your offense and wanting to join in my life. But for those that don't know, this is SMI, Surviving the Music Industry with Brandon Harrington. That is I. I'm speaking in your eardrums right now. That's what it sounds like. This is who I am. Thanks, everybody and everyone. Now, let's get down to brass tacks. In case you don't know, you're brand new to this thing. I'm Surviving the Music Industry, and then I get to talk to pretty rad people. One of those rad people, especially in this episode, Shannon McNally. And it was a pleasant conversation. I never knew or met Shannon. It was great. It was wonderful. We got to it. We did the thing. Now, the other brass tacks, the platinum tacks, I got to check on you people. How you doing? Are we all doing okay in this space and time? I'm back from, I mentioned last week that, you know, I've been everywhere. You know, if you do the thing, you've been literally everywhere. And I have a wife that wants to be part of my life, and I get to be part of hers. And we own a kid together, and they never really experienced a lot of America and what it has to offer. So we're being adventurous. We're checking out cities among the states, and the little hop to a station was St. Louis. So I'm back from St. Louis, but now we're visiting family in the Arkansas. In the Arkansas-y is where you're finding me right now. Save me. Get me out of here. I ran away years ago, but here I am. Back in it. I'm joking. I don't mind Arkansas. It's great. It's fine for what it is. I think everybody has this impression of their hometown or home state. It's like, there's very few people I've found in conversation that love this dynamic of home. I try to pick at it. It's a scab. I want to open up and figure out what is that thing. Because I usually had opposite feelings. And so it's interesting, like, to dive into somebody's psyche and like, why do you like home? Because that's a foreign concept to me. So I'm in the Arkansas. There's literally nothing to do here. We're just hanging out with family since the thing is opening up. Everybody seems to be comfy and kosher without masking. It feels like we're in a pandemic. Maybe we're in post-pandemic. What is this life out to be? Live shows are coming back. Congrats to all my friends and extended families that are doing the thing now. They're making some kind of income. They're staying relevant. They're jacking up their social numbers. They're selling tickets. Last I ever thought a ticket was going to be is if you didn't have a vaccine card. So it's getting back to normal. That's all I'm trying to say. So thanks, everybody, for doing the vaccine. That's not your thing. Whatever. I don't care. But at the same time, I think that's the kind of the big reason that we're kind of getting back to normal. People are vaxxed. People masked. People, like, took this thing relatively serious. And then live shows are back. Congrats, everybody. Congrats. Look at humanity. The strong will survive. And sometimes the idiots, too. I have no account to that whatsoever. But anyway, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts, feelings, emotions? I asked how you guys were doing, then I just went off in my thing. Keep in touch. At SMI Podcast. Facebook. I'm on Twitter, but nobody uses Twitter unless you're angry. I guess if you're angry, get in touch. At SMI Podcast. And then at Unofficial Brandon on the Instagram and the talks. I always get this pressure, like, to boost, like, social numbers. I'm not, the wizard of social media. I mean, I like it, but I don't know. It's so weird. It's so hard, like, to grow a thing on social media. Like, I mean, one, I don't have boobs. Well, I do have boobs, I guess. But it's the thing also, like, you go on TikTok and there's like all these millions of followers and it's like, where's the talent? What's the thing here? Oh, that's the thing. Okay. I get it. Playing what the mama gave him. Why not? I wish I could play that card. That's what's going on in my head these days, folks. Stay in touch. Keep in touch. Hope all is well. But I really think that I think it's on the Shannon. Okay, so to prep, just super quick, she was late. And I'm not talking late. Like, she was just, like, borderline forgot. Guys, I think something happened with her plane and like, travel the day before. Nonetheless, she popped up, screen to screen, and this was recorded a while ago. Because the record is out. It's the Waylon Sessions. Now, folks, I don't know how you feel about covers. I hate covers. Because I did the thing. I toured. All I thought covers were just pandering to people that just really just don't care about art. And they just, you know, as far as us on the stage wanting to play a cover, we're just pandering to your souls and your heart to get ready for the next thing. It was just a pit stop to get your heart pitter-patter onto something else. That's all it was to me. But folks, this record, The Waylon Sessions by Shannon McNally, is badass. I will be the first one to tell you that listening to this record kind of changed my heart, my soul, and my mind, my vision of records, like, based on covers. As you can guess it, she covers Waylon Jennings. And it is a record that will put a new perspective and a twist and a spin on songs that you thought you knew, but she didn't change anything. That's the beauty of it. It's just like you just hear the woman voice and then you start attaching things, but nothing's like really changed from the song. She was so true to the art and the craft of Waylon Jennings songs that the record still sounds like Waylon Jennings Band. And it sounds like a Waylon Jennings song. It is a Waylon Jennings song. It's just Shannon. It's just singing it. She's an amazing woman. She's done lots of crazy things. She's hit the road. She's done things. She's signed on the major labels and did that whole shtick and the whole thing. Some people might remember Jukebox Sparrows. It came out in the early 2000s. That was a big deal. And we go through some of the album cycles, so some of the big ones like in her life. But she has this infatuation with Louisiana. She's not from Louisiana. She's from New York, I think, from memory. Long Island, maybe. So it was interesting, the kind of poke and prod at that. Like, what's the love, the fascination of Louisiana? Because I'm from that area. There is a magic to it. It's a different world, that's for sure. But, like, what's the fascination behind it? Besides the state bird being a mosquito. I mean, what's the thing behind it? I don't know. Either way, it was a beautiful conversation. And I think the only thing that really set this up again is that she was just running a little bit behind. But it's okay. We recovered. We're two humans. And we got to the thing. And it was a lovely conversation. And I loved every moment of it. It was great. One of my favorite things in the entire world. All right. Things that you need to know before we move on. It's the Waylon Sessions. It's out. It's been out for a bit. Go listen. Go stream it. Go download it. Whatever you want to do with it right now. It just came out, and you'll enjoy it, especially if you love Waylon Jennings. It's your thing. Then you got to go to her website, shannonmcnally.com. Go visit her on her Facebook and all her other stuff, Shannon McNally Music, at Shannon McNally Music. All right, that's it for me, and we're getting to know one another. So here's my conversation with Shannon McNally.
Hello.
I see you.
Do you see me? Am I the wrong way?
You are the wrong way, so you got to fix that for me.
You want me to flip the phone over? Okay, hold on. Hold on, let's see. I am so sorry. All right, let me move this around a little bit.
It's almost there.
It's almost there. You are very kind. There we go.
No, not really. Not all the time.
No, all right.
No. Well, there it is.
Please accept my apologies. Can you hear me?
I do, yeah. So, I mean, you sound great. You look great. So far, I love where this is at. Because
the whole thing,
I'm like, there's something in my imagination, like, you're going to cut, like, an album full of Waylon songs. Like, why would I expect you to show up on time? Like, why? And so, like, if you showed up early, you just would have ruined everything for me. So just by being, like, 40 minutes late. No. Just 40 minutes late. You're a rock star in my world. This is it.
I am not aiming for that, so I do apologize. But thank you so much. It really is a technical it's a technical shortcoming that I have. I have a 12-year-old daughter who I put in charge of such things. So, so basically, you're dealing with a 12-year-old who is way more proficient than I am.
Yeah, they usually are. My kid is 8. And I mean, we're not on the technology thing. Our biggest thing in our life right now, he's dealing with a neighborhood bully.
Oh no!
Oh yeah!
Like outside?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, this is like old school, and you know, I'm a redneck.
That's old school. That's character building right there. That's all.
Okay. This is where I'm at. I think you're kind of getting it because it's
character building. Yeah. How big is this bully?
That's the shitty thing. Like he's 12, and my kid's 8.
Oh, so he's bigger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got a good, like, 25, 50 pounds on him.
Right. So you might want to be careful with the popping him in the nose business.
I know.
I'm not a dude, so I do recognize that there are, lovely differences between the sexes and genders. And I realize that that is a really intense conversation these days. But I don't know. I don't always know how to do it. But I do think that there's a certain amount of letting them work. I mean, as long as he's safe, letting him work it out. He's real smart. He'll figure it out. And if his mom has to go kick this kid's butt a little bit, then that's fine too.
Yeah, Mama Bear's about to come out. Yeah, yeah. But you get
that's
it.
That's the good news about being 8. Your mom can still come work this out for you. They're little boys and they're little kids. You know, I know you got to be careful with this. Really got to be careful with. I'm almost afraid to talk, but on some level sometimes, but they are little kids and they do have to work it out, you know, between themselves.
What are you scared of? You're a pro mom. You got a 12-year-old.
I'm a pro mom. No, yes, but I have a highly articulate, woke seventh grader. And so we're girl. I have a girl and we have this, there's a lot of gender conversation, a lot of pronoun conversation, all kinds of stuff. And honestly, I'm still new to it.
Oh, that's a real thing in your life. Yeah.
It's real thing. It's a real thing. And teenage, the whole junior high is real. Like enjoy this 8 years old thing. 'Cause junior high,
I'm not looking forward to it because, I mean, he's already having, like, the identity, like, anxieties, I guess, that, like, figuring out who they are, you know what I mean? And so, like, even this bully situation, he spent the whole night thinking about it. And it was just like, bro, let it go. So I can't imagine what junior high is going to be like.
It's really tough. And I don't remember, like, I don't see my point with her is just because she keeps telling me about all this identity crisis stuff, too, figuring out who she is and, exploring this. I just feel like the vocabulary is so powerful. It's so strong these days. And these kids they have this heavy sociology and psychology vocabulary that I don't know that they're entirely this isn't firsthand information. This is what they're hearing, and then they're sort of told that they're supposed to go through some sort of identity crisis, and then they're going to have to think it through. It's like, and I just keep telling her, honey, you're not having an identity crisis. You're 12. Your body hasn't even turned on yet. Like when your body turns on, it's going to be really obvious to you what you like. And in the meantime, you have friends, you know, before it's not a sexual relationship. Like they're so ahead of themselves and it's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not fair. I just, you don't have to have it figured out at 8 or 12.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? Like your body's not turned on yet.
Yeah. And that's such a weird thing. I can relate to that because I mean, at 8, I just cared about Ninja Turtles. I didn't give a fuck about anything else. You know what I mean? So as a 12-year-old girl, like, what's the situation? Like, just getting in the makeup, you know? Like, when, like, you were a kid, it's just like, where are these anxieties coming from? TikTok, I hate you, you know?
Right, you know, man. And are you there?
Yeah.
You know what? I better just plug this in real fast so that it doesn't die. But let me just grab my charger.
That's a good
idea. Yeah, let me grab my charger. I really can have it together when I try. I was just down in Lafayette, Louisiana for the weekend.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of at the mother church of, where'd you go? And I hadn't seen anybody and, you know, a year over a year.
And you lived down there for a bit, didn't you? Isn't that what I saw? You lived in Louisiana?
I lived in New Orleans, yeah. Mm. I lived in New Orleans, but Lafayette is sort of the last of the, you know, the free. It's the last of the free. I know that's the only way to put it. God, it was so nice to be there. I was like, oh, just so good. So yeah. Good. I was so happy to be. I mean, and people just drip songs and they don't, you know, it's changing like everywhere else, but it's still the land of the free.
Yeah. Louisiana Saturday night. That's still a thing there, you know?
It's still a thing, man. And Louisiana Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. It was awesome. And just everybody, you know, sort of waking up. Everybody was happy. Everybody was really happy. And I hadn't seen anybody in a long time. And I did spend quite a bit of time down there once upon a time. You know, I made two records at Dockside and Studios, which is in Maurice, Louisiana, which is south of I-10. Like, you know, like when you talk about Louisiana, there's different parts of Louisiana. There's New Orleans, there's North Louisiana, which is more like East Texas. And then you have South Louisiana. Anything south of I-10, you're in pure Cajun country.
Right, right. I saw this meme the other day that was perfect for Louisiana for me because I'm from Southern Arkansas and East Texas.
You know.
I got an idea, you know.
You know, you're from Arkansas, dude. You know.
I do. I mean, I've met enough like Cajuns, like I know how to decipher. I know exactly what they're saying. But the thing is, like this meme, it was perfect because I think unless you live there or you have any idea, you won't get it. But it was like basically I-10 was cut off and it was one shade and it said real Louisiana. And then, like, everything above that was, like, not Louisiana. That's what it said, not Louisiana. Like, it's not even the real thing. And I can agree with that because, like, going to Shreveport to do the thing, it's still, like, it's still Texas and still Arkansas. But dude,
it's
like,
East Texas. It's not even West Texas.
Yeah, I get it.
It's not Austin, you know. It's, just, it's kind of like, well, okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a different world. It's a different land. I'm glad you got the experience, but that's not where you're from. Where are you from originally?
I am originally from Long Island. I was born on Long Island.
Yeah, I hear that a little bit in the accent. Like, it's funny, like, listening to you talk. Yeah. Like, I feel like there's, like, a little Cajun there, but then I can hear a little bit of a Long Island draw. Like, did you know Mindy Smith? Did you guys ever hang out? Because I think she's from Long Island, too, right?
I don't know Mindy. We're Instagram buddies. I see her. We like each other's posts, but I've never met her.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, but Long Island's a funny thing. The connecting, I've lived all over the country. You know, I mean, I left home at 18. I went to college in Pennsylvania and then I got signed and went out to LA. Then I went to New Orleans on a day off on my first tour and was like, well, I don't have to live in LA. I can live in New Orleans. Why would I go back to, let's you be quiet. Come here. Why would I live in Los Angeles when you can live in Louisiana?
It wasn't your vibe. I could feel that. I lived in Hollywood for a month and I was out of place, like
it's
in
tough.
Hollywood. Yeah.
Yeah. I lived there for 4 years and I got a lot done, you know, and I learned a lot, but New Orleans and Long Island are very, very similar in this way. It's very Irish Catholic, very Irish Italian Catholic. It's a port town.
Yeah.
And the accent's not that far off. And
yeah, there's some similarities there, like accent
wise.
There's
a lot of similarities, yeah. And you know, and people ask me all the time, well, how'd you get into, you know, why roots music and blues and stuff on Long Island? But New York City, I mean, I don't know. When you grew up in, I didn't grow up in New York City. I grew up about 40 miles on, I grew up on the beach for one. I grew up on Jones Beach. It's the sort of the classic rock capital of the world. You know, the Grateful Dead were always coming through, and it wasn't, I don't know. I never thought of it like a regional thing.
Because when I think about Long Island, I kind of think, especially the people and the culture, I kind of have this, even though he really wasn't one, like this Springsteen mentality, like the working man kind of situation, you know? And
yeah, but Springsteen's from Jersey. I mean, Springsteen's only from, it's only 45 miles. It's not, you know, if you're from there, you think of New York and New Jersey as two different things. But if you're not from there, it's not different. Even when I was growing up, it was a farming community and a fishing community until, I would say, until the like real estate boom of the 80s. It was most of the east end of Long Island was, you couldn't give it away. It was just farms and a big Indian reservation. And it wasn't until the mid late 80s that it exploded as a, and my dad grew up going out there in the summers, and it was wild. It was very untamed. It was just anybody who had any money lived in the city, and they didn't live out on Long Island. Why would you live out on Long Island? That didn't happen until that's recent times. And now it's exploded, you know. It used to be different, but you know, whatever. But we don't have to talk about Long Island anymore.
No, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with sticking around for a bit because it's a different world. I mean, you know, you pop in like on tours or whatever now, like, and I have this one impression, but it's crazy to me, like, 40 minutes, you know, for me growing up, 40 minutes was nothing to go do something. In fact, you had to drive an hour, like, to go do anything. But, like, did you ever, like, go to the clubs or anything, like, in New York, like, growing up? Like, like CBGBs and stuff or anything like that?
You know, I really didn't, because when I was 18, I went away to college. And that just isn't the way I grew up. My parents wouldn't have let me be going to clubs at 16 years old in New York.
Pretty conservative parents?
Well, they were just sort of normal, you know. They loved music and stuff, but you know, that was New York City before Giuliani. Wasn't all that safe. Not now. I know Giuliani's lost his mind now, but back then it was, you know, New York was kind of seedy.
Right, right.
It was seedy until whatever they did. They just cleared everybody out for the real estate development and New York City changed.
Isn't it fun, like, knowing the history of New York, and, like, you think about Times Square, and at one point it was basically, like, porn street, like, dancers and, like, everything. Like,
yeah. It was seedy, you know. Right. It really was kind of seedy, and, you know, I was just, you know, I don't know. No, I wouldn't have gone to clubs before as a teenager, I went to see big shows at NASA Coliseum, and big shows were The Grateful Dead and Pink Floyd and Jimmy Page and Robert Plant and Aerosmith.
Those are some big ones for sure.
Oh yeah, they're big shows, and I live 15 minutes away. And the ticket, you know, back then tickets weren't, you know, it didn't cost $100 to go to a show. You could still go see a big show for 15, 20 bucks.
Right. You know. Right. So yeah, so you went to Pennsylvania. What? So I mean, you were a smart kid, right? Like, was school going to be the thing for you? Like, you just ended up wanting to go to school and, like, be a citizen of society?
Well, yeah, I thought I was going to be a veterinarian. And I was the first person in my family to go to college. My mom was a hairdresser, and my dad was a private investigator. And they never had, you know, they didn't, my mom didn't graduate high school, and my dad went in the Air Force, so they didn't go to college. And
But this is a big moment, because I understand the mentality of, like, the first kid or the first, like, of that generation, like, going to college. Did they put that on you, or did you have that in your head of, like, oh, this is pressure, I should do this?
It was a combination, you know. My mom was like, you know, you gotta go to college.
Yeah.
You know, and you gotta go to college. It wasn't even a conversation, really. But I was a smart kid, and I did well in school. And I, to some degree, I enjoyed school. I enjoyed learning, you know. Although I don't know that I liked school so much. I think that was tedious. But I did well in it. I did what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
I wasn't defiant. I was a defiant thinker, but I didn't have any defiance in me. I played sports, so I don't know. I was a soccer player all through school.
Mom and dad still together?
Well, they would be. My mom passed away 5 years ago. Yeah, thank you. It was, she had breast cancer, long, really hard bout, you know. So I took care of her for the last few years of her life. And I don't wish breast cancer on. I don't wish cancer on anybody.
Right.
It's brutal.
Cancer is like the one thing of like, why haven't we figured this out? You know what I mean? Like, they can churn out a vaccine like that quick on a dime, but cancer, they can't figure that one out.
Well, I think predominantly it's lifestyle, and it's an approach to food, and it's not understanding you are what you eat, and it's not understanding what you eat.
Is that your life? I mean, you believe that? Like, there's a, I don't know, gluten-free, like, it's a lifestyle, like, for you? I don't know how to phrase that or like what that is, but like health and wellness.
Yeah. I mean, I think all sickness is inflammation, and so much sickness is avoidable. I mean, obviously you're going to have, you know, genetic predispositions for things, and people are always going to, you know, there's always going to be exceptions to every rule, but all sickness is inflammation. And so much of our food system is just poisoned. You know, gluten didn't used to make everybody sick, and it doesn't make people sick in Europe. It's that the gluten here has been genetically changed so radically that our bodies are all allergic to it. It's like it's poison.
Yeah, there is a weird thing. I mean, I grew up on a ranch, so I had the luxury of like seeing what a real chicken looks like. You know, it's like when you see like these gargantuan Godzilla like chicken breasts, it's like, oh.
That God did not make that.
No, you know? No, not at all.
That came out of a lab. So yeah, you right. know, yeah. So that's what I think about most disease, you know. And then I'm also really into mushrooms and mycelium, and I think we have all the answers that we need. It's just that there's nobody can make money off of it.
Okay. Wait, now explain that to me. Like, are you talking like on a DMT level, like with shrooms and everything? Like, you go, like, do you have that experience?
Yeah. I mean, psilocybin and I mean, there's thousands of species of mushrooms.
Right. You know? Right. Right.
And essentially, one day when it clicks, and it's going to click soon, but they were doing all kinds of experiments up until the 70s when it just, you know, Nixon just cut that out, and they're sort of picking up where they left off now. But the mushroom industry, mycelium is the network. A mushroom is a fruit, essentially. It's the fruiting flower of the mycelium network, and there's thousands of different species, but it's fungi, right? It's
fungus. Right.
It's the life force on Earth, you know?
It sounds like a spiritual thing to you.
Well, it is a spiritual thing when you realize that you live on this planet, and you barely understand the system. But mycelium is what causes everything to decompose, right? So mycelium is the medium where things dead matter becomes living matter. So the God factor is unavoidable, and they can use mushrooms to fix any kind of toxic spell. It can literally turn toxic waste into healthy soil. You know, it's all ancient technology that
right.
It has always been. So of course it still works. We're just so conditioned to thinking, one, that you need a third party to tell you what's wrong with your body, a doctor.
Right, right. I mean, the Vikings were, like this was like part of their daily habit. You know what I mean? So it's like that old, but then old Tricky Dick Watergate wants to shut it down. You know, it's kind of
they were afraid, the powers that be, you know, were afraid of, they're really afraid of thought, not just on a cynical level, but you're still talking about people that are truly afraid of it, not beyond just being cynical assholes who, you know, are arrogant and know more and think they know more than everybody and want to control it. then the people who can't even make that leap are just afraid of it because they're afraid of it, even right. though it's as old as the ground, you know, the ground. We're talking about the ground. We're talking about, you know, and so it's easy to kind of, you know, get lost in the cosmic thought of it all, but it really is very, very simple, matter of fact. You can interrupt those patterns. And food is what they don't call it, the Food and Drug Administration, for nothing. You know? Food is a drug.
Yeah.
And everybody's addicted to it in one way or the other, and you can't live without it. So it's a real catch 22.
Dude, no kidding. Like, when did you start like experimenting with this?
I've always been interested in food as medicine and music as medicine. I've always been interested in the concept of medicine. I went to college for, I got a 4-year degree in religious anthropology.
So you went for vet school, but you got something in anthropology?
Yeah, first semester, freshman year, I figured out labs weren't for me.
Yeah, I like pets. I don't want to see inside of them. I'm good.
I don't mind seeing inside of them, but I wasn't going to get past all the chemistry labs. And it was pretty apparent pretty fast, you know. So that didn't work for me.
But this is something, anthropology. It seems like it would cross there, you know, especially like medicine, healing. It seems like there's a crossroads or like a junction there with herbal medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, music is medicine. You know, we know this on a cellular level, you know, and it took me a while to figure out, because I realized the thing that is sort of, you know, I like this concept of being interrupted, you know, this, because we get interrupted on our path, and that's what makes new paths, you know, those interruptions that you sort of ricochet about. And some of us ricochet harder than others, and some of us follow those gut instincts. You know, your gut is your brain. It all sort of comes back to that. But all the music that I always really loved and gravitated towards was, it had a shamanistic, medicinal quality, you know, whether it was Bob Dylan or Willie Nelson or Nina Simone or, you know, Miles Davis or whatever it was that I always knew it was medicine. It was medicine of a kind, you know. And then it just like gathering information as, you know, as you go through life. And that's all. I'm rambling at this point.
No, I mean, I've welcome. There's like a, I don't know. To me, that screams experience. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't go through these things or these thoughts and emotions in your head without experiencing the other side of it. You know what I mean? And so, yeah. Like, when I look at your history and I look at your music, and you have a shit ton of music. I didn't realize, like, your catalog was so vast and just so large. I had no idea. Like, I was blown away. And it all started, like, in the Capitol years.
Yeah.
So, like, shortly after college, right?
Yeah, right after college. I hung around. I went to school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in the heart of Amish country. And
those wagon riders.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Amish.
Yeah.
And Mennonites, big Amish Mennonite community.
Yeah, there's a big one where I grew up, too. So that's how I can even relate to it. There's a big Mennonite community.
Yeah. Well, then, you know, there's people who can really do things with their hands. You know, they can grow anything. They can build anything. They can raise anything. You know,
I am. Come fix my crawl space. You know what I mean? Like, they could just whittle something, be done with it.
Oh, I believe me. Yeah.
I want to say that was probably my fault.
Come here.
I scared him.
Oh no, I have a gigantic bay window, and he guards the house. He's not.
He does a good job.
He does. He's not going to stop. So let me just put him upstairs for a second.
Okay.
Come on. All right.
I love that chair, by the way.
Oh, I love this chair. I got it I love it. I found it somewhere. I don't remember. A long time ago.
That's cool.
That's my favorite chair.
Yeah, so somewhere you got You got signed. I mean, you were, I felt like this is obvious. It feels obvious. Like you've been doing music this whole time at somehow, some capacity. And then somebody recognized you. They saw this brooding talent of some kind, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been making music since I graduated school. When I graduated, I hung around Lancaster for a year. And that's when I was sort of playing little clubs and writing songs. And then I had one week the following summer, Jerry Garcia had just died. It was a year after Jerry died. And so it was the first year of the Further Fest, and which was when all the Grateful Dead splintered into all the various bands, you know, and Los Lobos came through town. And I really didn't know what the hell I was doing or how to do it. I had no idea, like, how do you make records? How do you get signed? No idea, just none. And they came through, and I spent a few days seeing them and tagging along to the Further Fest with them. And because they were just the nicest guys in the world, and they were so cool. They were so cool. And sort of spun my head around. I was like, oh, well, they live in Los Angeles. And they're from Los Angeles. Maybe I should go to Los Angeles. Who had ever thought about Los Angeles? I don't know. I hadn't. And simultaneously, I went to see the Cowboy Junkies.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And they're such a great band. And Margo Timmons, the lead singer, you know, she's sort of winding the show down and said, I'm going to stick around after the show. If you want to say hi, please, I'll be at the merch table and all this. And my roommate looked at me and she said, she gave her your tape. It was a cassette tape too. And I was like, really? She goes, absolutely. So we ditched out. We went back to the apartment. We came all the way back. This was insane. We went and got the tape, came all the way back up, and we were they let us back in the building. And I gave the tape to Margo, and her manager picked it up on the bus and called me. And he managed he managed the 10,000 Maniacs and the Grantley Buffalo and them. And he called me, and I thought it was a joke. This is like a week after or before I saw Lobos. And he said, what are you doing? You know, you should come out to Los Angeles. I'll introduce you to some people, and we'll get you a publishing deal. And I was like, I had no idea. And I thought, oh, Los Angeles.
Yeah,
that's where Los Lobos lives.
Yeah.
So I went out there. And so I've been making records a long time, you know. I've been, my first record was I had no management. So I went signed straight to a major label. I really didn't know how to write songs in a formal way. I didn't know how to play my instruments all that well. And I sure didn't know how to do a lot of stuff, but I met some really great session guys in LA, and I had a great record collection. And I didn't realize it, but I sort of started right at the top of the heap, you know?
Yeah. I mean, swinging.
I came out swinging. I really did. Cause I mean, the first band I put together in the studio was Greg Lease and Bob Glaub and Jim Keltner and Ben Montench. And it was like,
studs in their own world.
They were all, and the thing that I didn't understand at the time was because I was on a major label and they were still spending money like just water.
Oh, yeah. Know? I bet this was like a $500,000 project.
Like I was going to say, my first record, including all the touring and everything, but they busted my balls. I mean, the first record took 4 years to put out because they changed presidents 3 times.
Oh, so they shelved it for a little bit or were going to, and then somehow it got released later on.
My A&R guy hid me. He literally hid me. He hid me from the suits.
So this guy's the superhero, like in the story. Like he's a hero protagonist.
He busted my balls too, and it was very depressing, but I got to thank him because for 4 years, he ended up getting fired before my record came out. From the last the third president. And the guy who came on as the third president was kind of very, didn't really get it. And, but eventually sort of came around and put it out. And I got a tour with John Mellencamp.
That doesn't seem very, I mean, that's huge. That's cool. But that doesn't seem very LA capital to me, you know, like the risk factor. Was it just because like this A&R guy, before he got fired, he believed in it so much, it eventually got released?
Well, it was yes. Mm. Because at the time it was the philosophy, if you were an A&R guy, at the A&R philosophy was spend so much money that they have to put it out.
Yeah, it's undeniable. We did all this. Go.
If you don't spend enough money, like you literally had to just, you had to create this boulder that they had to then explain, you know, because they're all, it's all, at the time, I don't know what it's like now, but it was just all accountants and lawyers and gangsters. They were all gangsters. They didn't give a shit. They were all drug dealers. I mean, it was just, it was all drug money. It was all bullshit, you know, and so his philosophy was spend as much. I'm on the hook for $1 million for that first record. When I get the statements from Capitol, from EMI, it says $1 million. Now,
do you still see those statements? Do you still see
them? Oh, yeah, I still get them. I didn't see any of that money, you know.
No, of course you
didn't. And they all paid themselves pretty heavily, you know, but but that's why I could call, you know, at that time. So in LA, the session rate, you were either it was either single scale, double scale, and then. But if you were, if you were a true royalty like Jim Keltner, you got triple scale, right? So, and that was basically $1,000 a day, $2,000 a day, or $3,000 a day. So when I put a band in the studio for one day, now Jim was the only triple scale guy I had, but everybody else did it for double scale. But, you know, I mean, you would have $10,000, $15,000 days without even blinking.
Right.
I mean,
this is normal.
That's back in the day when, you know, you had $1 million budgets. And these were these were development budgets. These weren't even, it was massive money. But I didn't really understand any of that. I was just making artistic decisions. And it was all funny money to me. It was all monopoly money to me anyway. You know, what did I know?
I mean, it's all thrown at you. It's not yours, you know, so it's like.
No, and you're never going to get it back. Those deals are 90-10 splits, and then you pay out of your 10%, you pay everything off, and it's all complete horrific bullshit. But.
You went through 2 album cycles, though, like with this.
I did. I went through that first, and the first one took 4 years, and I put out an EP first, and then the full length. And then I went in to make another one. When I made Geronimo, I figured my days had to be numbered because I was just pushing my luck.
You felt that pressure?
Well, stylistically, my stuff had a real, like a kind of a masculine edge, but I didn't appeal. But I didn't really appeal to the Indigo Girl crowd, you know? So it was like, I was in between. I was a man with no country.
My first recollection, like listening to Geronimo or like Jukebox Sparrows, is like, okay, like maybe this is a Meredith Brooks kind of thing, you know? Like there's a like strong, what does that make you feel? Does that make you?
That's okay. That's really funny though. Is that the I'm a Bitch song?
yeah. That's that lady. Yeah, that's her.
We were out. Okay, that's funny because we were label mates. And anyway, it's really okay. That's just a name I haven't heard in a long time.
I know, me either. I because it only popped up when I listened to it. And I thought, okay, maybe this is what Capitol is doing with her. But then, like, when I listened to Geronimo, it starts feeling like this detachment. Like, it starts, like, pulling away from this idea of whatever this rock Meredith Brooks, like, power statement situation is to something a little bit more. Not, I don't want to say folky, but it just seemed Americana. I hate the word Americana, so I don't know.
Well, Americana didn't even really exist at the time. Right. Yeah, right. I think what you're hearing is Geronimo. You know, I was really into the Bob Dylan's Love and Theft record and Time Out of Mind. He just made Time Out of Mind, and which was a really big record for me. And then he made Love and Theft, they didn't know. They had no idea what to do with me because I wasn't interested in, you know, I wanted to make really, you know, good. I wanted to make good records, and they didn't have, Americana wasn't really a thing. I mean, Lucinda was out there doing stuff, and all the Americana royalty were all still sort of fringe country artists. You know, they weren't, Americana has only existed a short while, and it was based on Levon Helm and the band, mm-hmm. you know, and like Levon, sort of the archangel of Americana. And I worshiped the band and Levon.
Yeah, I did too.
And I knew, you know, I knew him. I dogged him pretty hard. I chased him around all the time. I'd go see him live. Oh yeah, I loved him. And I'd go see him live all the time. And
you got some rad Levon stories?
I got a couple, yeah.
Yeah, I want to hear one.
Well, he was after his throat cancer and before he sort of his resurgence, he, I guess around the year 2000, 2005, he was playing with a couple of little regional bands out of Woodstock and Long Island. And so he was easy to find, you know, and you could just go, and they were just little, these were just little club shows, little honky tonks.
Right.
It wasn't hard to find him, you know.
And basically anybody could go to the Pink House, you know, like you could just drive up to it.
Oh yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And, but he would play just really little venues around New York and Long Island. And so I would go see him a bunch, and my thing with him was I never really knew what to talk to him about, and I didn't want to bug him, you know, but I was 25 years old, and
you had to play it cool.
And
how
cute.
Could you play it cool?
Yeah.
With
so it wasn't too hard to get him talking. It was harder to keep him talking, you know?
Yeah.
So I would ask him for directions because he liked to do all his own driving and he liked to do all his own driving and he liked to take major interstates or thoroughfares. So I would ask him directions like, well, what's your favorite route from Little Rock to Woodstock? You know, I can't remember half the shit he said, but
right.
I remember
just hearing him ramble.
And he had perfect. The cutest accent. I mean, yeah. My God.
Nobody sounded like Levon. Like
no.
There was only one voice.
Yes. Yeah. And just the things he said, you know, he'd be, you know, the whole time you're talking to him, he'd be rolling joint after joint after joint after joint. And just whatever came out of his mouth was interesting to me. You know,
yeah.
I loved him. I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. But, and then I was living in New Orleans and, you know, I got to be real good friends with Bobby Charles and Dr. John.
I knew about the record. Because I was going to bug you about that, hanging out with Dr. John, because that's another big character in my head. You know what I mean? But I don't know that because I've never met him. He just seems so like cartoonish.
Well, yeah. I mean, the number one is, of course, is that Jim Henson based the entire Muppet Show on him. So
yeah.
There's a reason that you think of him.
Yeah.
You know, as children's TV because, and he's also the voice of, Curious George, you know, he sings the Curious George song. Yo, yeah, Mac was like, Dr. John, his real name was Mac Rebenack. Oh no, he wasn't like anybody else on earth. And he spoke his own language. We call it Macanese. And it was basically New Orleans jive from the 50s, you know.
Right.
And he, not like anybody else I've ever met on earth. I mean, I think there used to be a lot more characters like that. It's a South Louisiana thing. That's a New Orleans thing. Like the medicine, you know, a real medicine man sort of, because he was from New Orleans and he was real tight with the Mardi Gras Indians. And the whole idea behind the Mardi Gras Indians is that around the turn of the century, when the Wild Bill Hickok show was going around the country, Sitting Bull is in Wild Bill Hickok's Traveling West show, basically getting paid in meat and blankets for his people on the res. you know, so it's, this is a sick time in American mm-hmm. history, but the Wild Bill Hickok show came to New Orleans. It was sort of the first contact that a lot of people in New Orleans had with Plains Indians, you know, so it was very sort of fantastical. It's already a mixture of Catholicism and Haitian and Creole and all this, you know, it's a real melting pot. Mm. But, you know, in New Orleans, obviously, they celebrate Mardi Gras. And Mardi Gras is this big day before Ash Wednesday, before Lent, when you let your soul out. And so the whole concept of New Orleans music is drums talking, rhythms speaking to other realms, your ancestors and to the dead. And so Mac Rimanak, Dr. John, was really sort of a, you know, he was a high priest of this communication. And it's, anybody who's really ever seen talking drums or really been in New Orleans when it's really powerful and uncut, it's otherworldly, and it's just deep, you know, there's no bottom to New Orleans. Man. So Mac, this is what Mac comes out of. His influence on anybody that grew up, you know, before the 90s is there, whether you know it or not. And right, it sort of right. informs your sense of humor and your sense of earthiness, but you couldn't, you know, and then I met Mac a bunch of times, and then before, but I was also good friends with Bobby Charles. So, and Bobby was the same way, except he was, he was real Cajun, you know, in Lafayette. And of course he lived in Woodstock with the band and Albert Grossman and that whole world. So yeah. they were, I mean, if these things resonate with you, there was no,
oh, it does.
When they were in the room, there was no avoiding their presence.
Yeah, Bobby was on, wasn't Bobby on the last waltz? Like, and then Scorsese, like, cut out his performance, but he's not, like, on the last bit, something like that?
Bobby refused to be filmed.
Was that the story? Is that it? Oh, wow.
That's the story, yeah. I mean, Bob Dylan wouldn't come out of his room. That, you got to remember, those guys were all out of their minds, too. And they were the first.
They all hated each other. They were out of their minds.
There was just a lot of weed and cocaine and whiskey, right. and they were nuts.
I mean, those characters don't exist anymore. That's what makes me interested, like, especially you going into this Waylon record. You just attracted the characters. I mean, is that your shtick? Like, you just like people.
You
just
know what? They like
mind.
Me. I like them, and we find each other. I've come to realize that. Yeah. I don't think I used to set out thinking I'm going to find the biggest characters I can find. I think I just used to gravitate to, like, you know, like-minded people gravitate towards like-minded people. And mm-hmm. not that I'm entirely like-minded, you know, I like my sleep a whole lot, and I can't, you know, I couldn't, those guys were all, they didn't need as much sleep as I do.
Oh, no, but, kidding. Yeah, as I was waiting on you, there's a little jab there. I was kind of wasting time just watching some Waylon interviews. And every time Waylon crosses my mind, I always think about the interview that he walked out on. Like, and they had to fill 15 minutes on the Late Late Show. But then, like, there was a clip on with him on Letterman. Like, the dude, like, in the 70s and 80s, was spending $1,000 on drugs a day. That's a shitload of cocaine.
We got to remember, cocaine was a lot more expensive back then, too. This is all pre-meth. I don't know what, they were all spending. And Johnny Paycheck, yeah. I remember hearing the number Paycheck. They think Johnny Paycheck spent on cocaine over the period of course of his life. But
they didn't call him Paycheck for no reason. He spent the whole thing on cocaine. Duh.
They were all out of their minds. But you get it. Yeah. I mean, it was like, you're only talking about a 15-year period of time. It's not like it went on forever and ever, you know. Right. They were all doing trucker drugs in the 60s. They were smoking weed, drinking whiskey. All country music, you know, was run back to Hank Williams. It was all run on weed and whiskey and cocaine. I mean, that's not new. It's not new. In fact, all of those drugs were infinitely milder than they are today. Because they weren't synthetic, and they weren't cut with fentanyl and all this crap that will kill you instantly.
Right.
You know, it actually, it was just a completely, you know, chemically speaking, it was just utterly different. Not that I'm backing it. I'm not supporting it. It's just that those guys.
I'm not hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah, no. And they had constitutions that could handle it, obviously, you know.
Interesting. Like, when you think about Waylon, like you think about these stories and all those outlaw guys. And like, did you get any of that impression? Like, I assume that you hung out with Jesse as you were doing this record.
And well, once I cut it, I called her.
Oh, you called her. Oh, okay.
I called her and I said, I did this. I did this. And
is it okay?
Is it okay? Like, she said, sister, you're nuts. I would have gone, okay, I won't touch it. I mean, it's really all I cared about was her opinion and Connie Nelson. I met Connie Nelson and they both said rock on. So
yeah,
I rocked on.
I mean, there had to be common ground, even to spin off what you were just saying and not to completely avoid it by any means. But like, there's like this thing of like with country artists and like white country artists with pot, it was all this inner circle thing that it was never talked about. And then time changes. And yes, there is like this brown stigma like attached to it, right? And it's like white America like did that to this culture. But these songs and right. Yeah. Government control propaganda.
Right.
So when we're going into now in this open free air, and we know who Waylon is, we knew all the things that he's done and he is, and you have some kind of feeling and association with him. Do you feel linked to that in some way? Especially like standing up for who Waylon is or was, because when you look at Waylon, like you never thought, well, there's a racist bone in that dude's body. Like he's just Waylon, like he's just rock and roll. And like he accepted, he was the most like, from what I understood, like the most accepting guy of all cultures.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Believe me. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I mean, Waylon's first, you know, Waylon was not a racist and he was not a sexist. He wasn't an asshole. He was an existentialist. He was a real, he was a thinker and he was creative, just like Willie Nelson. So, you know, they thought for themselves and they weren't party line with anything, you know, like Chris Stopson, like Johnny Cash, none of them, those guys were not party line on anything and they weren't, and they didn't need the industry. They had a certain amount of freedom because they could go play roadhouses and Indian casinos. Waylon would go to the, you know, he'd just go back to the South. He needed to make a bunch of money. He'd go play reservations.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, it's funny, like maybe I put that stigma on them. Like when I think about some of the outlaw guys that we just named.
Wait, what's the stigma?
Well, that's maybe what I put on it. So that's what I'm trying to figure out, that it's a right political statement. But in actuality, like those guys were really progressive. I just feel like the association with a certain sect of people that like the music or appreciate who they are, that's the stigma, right? Because these guys, like, I mean, they were all progressive thinkers. They were real deep thinkers.
Oh, you're saying that the stigma is that these are country music artists, and so, and the stigma is that modern country is sort of shuffling right now, it just lost its mind and can't backpedal at all, and has boxed itself into a racist corner.
Right.
Well, you got to remember that is a very modern thing. I mean. Mm-hmm. Willie and Waylon and it gets complicated because you're still dealing with a lot of people, you know, I identify with Waylon. I've always identified with him, but I was concerned. I wanted to make sure that I, remembered everything correctly and that I was, you know, I mean, these days I don't want to have anything to do with, you know, you can't rewrite history, but I don't want to have anything to do with racist, misogynistic assholes who, you know, were sort of tolerant of the Klan. I don't want anything to do with it. I mean,
and
zero,
that's my point.
But
like,
I grew
they
up
weren't.
On Sesame Street.
Yeah.
I'm coming at this from Sesame Street.
Yeah. I'm hearing you.
I don't want anything to do with all that bullshit. And In fact, I called Jessie Coulter, his wife, and I played her the record. And I also decided that because I'd never heard a woman do any of this stuff, but I wanted to talk to all the women that he knew and ask them. Like, you want to know what a guy's like, you just call all the women that know him. So I talked to Jessie, and I really talked to her a lot about, he was surrounded by highly fantastic, intelligent women, all beautiful, strong, real smart, real talented. And so I thought, well, that hasn't been, you know, I wonder what they thought. So I talked to Jessie, and then I got to know Connie Nelson really well, who was married to Willie for years. And the two, you know, they were all best friends. And I asked Connie, I talked to Carlene Carter, June Carter's daughter. I talked to Emmy Lou Harris and a number of other women who knew him, including my hairdresser. They loved him. They loved him, and he loved them. You know, he loved women, but he not in a sleazy way, you know, but he was a thinker, and he just had a gut. You know, he and Willie Nelson, both of them, the reason they were good buddies was because they sort of saw the world the same way. And they didn't put things in real narrow boxes, even though they're archetypal dudes. I don't know. I think it comes from having self-confidence and, you know, a healthy ego and a healthy sense of vulnerability. They weren't perfect. They were wonderfully imperfect. They loved him. Yeah. So I figured, all right. And, you know, also, I mean, you know, the Native American connection is really, really strong. And he's from West Texas. You know, he's a cowboy. Mm-hmm. And the fact that his favorite people were all Native Americans, I mean, what else you need to know about him? I checked all my facts just to make sure I wasn't. I think being sensitive and caring about how other people feel is, you know, it is important. And particularly, it's just like, enough is enough. Like, say you're fucking sorry and act it and act right and stop being a racist asshole.
That's what I appreciate out of this, because like, if you read a book about Waylon, like, you understand these things, but then it's that outlaw stigmatism of a country dude and a white dude in music, and you have this one impression. But then, like, so far, there hasn't been any dirt, like the dirtiest of the dirt in today's, like, cancel culture, which is always in the back of my fucking mind of, like, this is a thing in show business, and it could just happen at any moment. But then, like, I feel like with a white woman covering some Waylon Jennings songs, it's almost like, oh, here's a stamp. Like, that's actually a decent human being. Like, he had the great songs. This brings a whole new perspective to these songs. But then it solidifies of, like, especially if you're doing the due diligence, it's like, yeah, this shuts down all those stigmatisms toward that whole group.
All it says is that these knucklehead country bros these days, they have a choice, and they're just not making it.
Yeah.
And all their heroes would beg to differ that they don't have a choice. You know, with the Waylon stuff, I did feel a little bit like I'm tired of him being portrayed in this one-dimensional way. You know, and Willie Nelson lives longer, you know, and Willie's got more people vouching for him. And who cares what I say? I mean, I don't expect country music to care what I say. It's just that it lit me up, and I do what lights me up. And I did my due diligence just to make sure, because this is a world where I got to promote it, and I'm going to talk about it, and people are going to, you know, it's going to be examined through a lens. But I didn't want to see Waylon. I was tired of seeing Waylon lumped in a narrow perspective, because he was anything but narrow, you know. And I just thought, these songs are romantic, they're vulnerable, they're smart, and they're tough, and they have higher purpose. So I don't know. I sure didn't think about all of that when I went in to do it.
Oh, really? That's the crazy thing to me. Oh, wow.
I really didn't. I mean, I had the idea, and I was in the studio really fast. Once, you know, I sort of hooked up with Blue Rose and realized I had the funding. I mean, I called Kenny Vaughn real fast. The only thing I was worried about was getting the band right. That's the toughest thing. That was all I cared about. Everything, right. You know, we now talk about music so much more than we make it. And I understand why, but nothing matters except what it sounds like. We can talk about it all day long. And all I really cared about was getting the band right. And stylistically.
Right. Because there's a swagger to it. There's a thing to it that... Kenny Vaughn is one of those people. It's like, that dude can nail it. He understands it. And like him to get the right people, that just only makes sense. But yeah, there's a swagger to it. That's only right.
Well, it's authentic.
Yeah.
You know, and he brought in Chris Scruggs. And, you know, I did want everybody to be sort of one degree of separation from Waylon. Yeah. And I wanted it to be personal. Because I wanted to keep it as close to an energetic center as I could, because to me, all that matters is the energy of it. Kenny was my, I called Kenny and said, what do you think about this? Would you be interested in this? And he immediately said yes. And he told me about seeing Waylon in 1973 in a dinner, in a supper club where Waylon performed quite a bit in Arizona. And he told me about the feeling in the room when Waylon walked on stage. And it raised the hair on the back of my neck. He said, you know, in 1973, Waylon was a good looking, tall guy. But like better than just good looking, he had presence.
There was a dominance for sure.
Yes. Yeah. And it was unusual. It wasn't like anything else. And
it wasn't like a Buck Owens, like showy thing. Like it was just, that's the dude. Like you knew when a giant entered the room.
There's a giant in the room. And he said, so this supper club, it's like a Saturday night or Friday night. And it's like couples night, you know, like you come in, you get a table, you get a setup, which is what a setup is. You get your glasses and your ice and you bring your own. He said that when Waylon walked on stage, every dude in the place got mad. And every woman in the place went, oh. And so just walking on stage, you know, it did this thing to the room. And that's exactly how that was exactly my impression of how I interpreted it would have gone. And that's just an impressive presence. That's a huge person walking into the room that just it pissed all the dudes off because the attention just shifted. But when I heard Kenny tell me that story, I thought, yes, that's what I want to hear on this record. Marty Stewart had the week off, and so I only booked a session because Marty Stewart had the week off, and I wanted the two of them. And I thought, if I had the two of them, I can't fuck this up. Because it really meant a lot to me that the guitars be right. And then, of course, they brought in Fred Newell on pedal steel. And he also played lead guitar, some acoustic guitar, and lead electric guitar. And he played all the harmonica.
Yeah, he's a beast.
He's a beast. Yeah. And he called me Haas the whole time. And
that makes sense. I love that.
I was terrified. He walked in, I was like, God, I'm an idiot. Why did I do this? I'm so embarrassed.
That is a thing. That's interesting.
It's terrifying.
Because this is a huge undertaking. And like you didn't pick like the hits. You picked some deep cuts, like some Billy Joe Shaver stuff. And then like you cut one of my favorites, like Out Among the Stars. That's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah. And I mean, and these aren't like all songs like everybody just gravitates toward Waylon, you know, but these are like really intimate, like Waylon songs.
Right. Well, to me, he's a great balladeer.
Mm.
He sang great ballads. You know, he was a crooner.
Yeah.
Kind of like Elvis.
Yeah, you know, he loved Elvis. Yeah.
He's more like Elvis to me than true. Yeah, you know, so, yeah, I'm glad. So they brought in Chris. And once I knew I had them, then and they brought in Derek Mixon on the drums. Derek, he's from Shreveport. He plays with Chris Stapleton. Yeah. So I knew I didn't have to explain. You know, I knew that that was covered.
Right.
Because I do like that, you know, there's the elements of that, you know, outlaw dude man that I really like. I don't want to fix that. I don't want to change that. I don't want to put heels and lipstick on that. I want it to be what it is. And I just wanted to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So that, and then we brought in Bucca Allen. Buck is from Austin, and Buck is Terry Allen's son, and Terry Allen is just a living treasure.
Terry's the songwriter, like in my head, like Terry Allen, the artist, yes. Songwriter. Okay,
yes.
Okay,
yes, that's the same guy. Yeah, you know, okay. Juarez and Lubbock on Everything.
That's
and,
it. Yeah,
Amarillo Highway. Yeah, Give Me a Ride to Heaven. Yeah, I mean, just so. In some ways, I felt like I knew what I was talking about. I knew I was just right on an instinctive level because Terry is he's that too. He's that thing, you know. Same with Billy Joe Shaver. I got to meet Billy Joe Shaver a bunch. I just wasn't pulling it out of the ether. I had.
No. Like when you listen to it, there's. You could tell, like, oh, well, there's a flanger guitar. There's the feel of it from the drums. It's like, oh, this is authentically what it is. It's almost like you could have taken the masters, like, from the originals and, like, just plop your voice on it, like, to be honest with you. Like, and that would have been fine, probably even cheaper, but who knows? But the thing about it, like, the perspective is so unique and beautiful about it. Like, there's such a, like, I don't want to say, like, a woman perspective, but there's just, like, this nurturing aspect to it, like all the songs that I really loved, and that was my takeaway from the record.
I really like that. Well, you know, it's really done lovingly. I mean, I think that's, if that's what you mean, it's like,
yeah,
I like that. I like that a lot. You know, it's that's what I just wanted to do that thing and keep it alive.
The last artist I played for had no idea who Waylon Jennings was. And so, like, even when I was in, this is a country artist, and then also, like, we got on something like A Boy Named Sue, Johnny Cash, and I was using that as a reference or something, had no idea what I was talking about. And that's when I said, I'm not needed, like, in this world anymore.
Like, well, I know a lot of people who feel that way, and you are needed in this world. I feel absolutely irrelevant, you know, and now it's like on some level, but on another level, it's like dealing with a little kid. They don't know what they don't know, and they don't know what they need, you know, and right. They don't know what they're going to like until you just put it in front of them, you know? So I don't know.
You're doing the Lord's work, sister.
I'm doing the Lord's work.
Yeah.
And I'm doing it on a very selfish level.
Yeah. Why not? I mean, you're going to do it. Like, do it for yourself.
Why not? There's no rules anymore. Yeah. Nobody knows the difference.
Right.
I mean, half the shit that's out there that is awful, people are jumping up and down about, and you're like, are you kidding me? But that's because they don't even know what's good. That's like drinking, you know, grape knee-high, thinking this is a really nice Merlot. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if you try it, you know.
That's a good one. But you're doing all right. You know what
I'm
I mean?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing great, and I love his record, and I feel really inspired, and just got my COVID shot, so I'm very excited to be out and back out and feeling everything, waking up. It's spring, and feel like, you know, with the vaccine, and it's spring, and I don't know. I think it's all going to be really good, and I make records for the sake of it.
Yeah, you know? You're doing it. I like that. That's good.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, thank you.
Yeah, are we done here?
Probably. I don't know how I can top that.
She easily could have. She could have topped anything because she was great. Great human being. That dog. I forgot all about the dog. But anyway, you guys made it this far. Thanks for checking out. checking out the life and music of Shannon McNally. And of course, the Waylon Sessions. If this is your stick, this is your bag, this is the thing that you get into, which I highly recommend, you should. It's really good. It's worth the time. It's worth the money. It's streaming everywhere. The Waylon Sessions is out. You can go visit her website too, shannonmcnally.com, or any of her social platforms, Shannon McNally Music. And you can check out the record from any of those areas, music platforms. We all got them, right? Use a search bar, people. Seriously. And then, as for me, use the search bar again. At SMI Podcast, wherever. At Unofficial Brand at Instagram and Talks, wherever. And then smipodcast.com, send us a line, check out all the extra content, extra little clickety-clicks there, whatever floats your boat. Use the search bar. Why do I have to say it? I think we're all fully aware of what this thing does and what it is. But I appreciate you people. I love you people. Thanks for listening to the show, more importantly. And then I think if you got something out of this, something just reached down to your soul and said, I feel connected, all I ever ask is that you just share it. We're having new episodes every Tuesday. Be on the lookout. Sometimes I sprinkle a little something on Thursdays as well. Best way to know, best way to keep in touch is to subscribe and follow in your favorite podcast app. And I think that's it for me. I think you people know the usual. All right. Happy surviving. Until next time. Harmony.